Hello and welcome to Science World. New 3D printers are beginning to play a major role in developing new technologies. George Putich tells us how surgeons are now using them to help plan heart surgeries. Speaking of new technology, we'll hear how U.S. law enforcement officials are using powerful cameras to scan license plates and build databases on the movements of millions of Americans. And we'll talk with a researcher whose team has just discovered a correlation between climate shifts and human behavior. The study reveals that these deviations tend to make people more violent. This and much more are coming up for you on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. 3D printers are entering everyday life, and they are increasingly being used in medicine. Doctors at Washington's Children's National Medical Center say the life-size tri-dimensional prints of their patients' hearts helps them in planning and executing surgeries. George Putich has more.
Magnetic resonance imaging, computer tomography, and ultrasound already give pretty good images of patients' internal organs. But doctors say nothing beats holding a life-size model of a heart in your hand prior to the surgery. They can study it, plan the procedure, and even practice the access to the damaged area. Pediatric cardiologist Laura Olivieri says many young patients were born with hearts that did not form as they should have, but surgeons can correct that.
Seeing the heart defect in three dimensions can really help the interventionalist or the surgeon plan the best procedure.
The procedure starts with taking a set of three-dimensional images with a magnetic resonance imager, a computer tomography scanner, and an ultrasound machine. Pediatric cardiologists manipulate those images and isolate the organ in the picture. To save time in printing, they sometimes cut away parts of the image irrelevant to the planned procedure. Mechanical engineer Alex Krieger is the principal investigator for pediatric surgical innovation at the Children's National Medical Center.
It takes us now on average, I would say, about 2 hours of manual work on the computer to manipulate the data to generate the 3D model. And the printer takes about, for a full-size heart like this, it takes about 12 hours. A smaller heart, you know, like maybe 5-6 hours.
Krieger says his team recently printed a model of the heart of a patient with stenosis, or narrowing of the passage between two heart chambers. The interventional cardiologist wanted to see exactly what kind and size of stent he should use and also the access path.
So this model allowed him to really look at that in depth and plan and prepare for the procedure better.
The machine prints by spraying layers of plastic. Krieger says the printer can be loaded with two different materials. Precise control of their ratio allows the printed model to feel very natural with both hard and soft tissues. Cardiologist Laura Olivieri says doctors still have to learn a lot about the new procedure.
It's a brand new field. These have only been possible for a very little amount of time, and I don't think we even know the full capability of what we're going to be, what they're going to be used for. We're kind of talking about a technology that's going from feasible to kind of usable, and we're right in that middle ground right now.
There is hope that someday hospitals will be able to print even replacement parts for damaged organs.
That's the ultimate goal, but I think there are a few steps in between that we will reach in the next few years on the way to full organ printing that I'm very excited about.
George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Law enforcement agencies across the U.S. are using powerful camera technology to scan license plates and build databases on the movements of millions of Americans. Jeff Swicord reports from Arlington, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C.
Arlington County Police Detective Mohammed Tabibi is with the Auto Theft Unit. He uses license plate readers, or LPRs, mounted on the hood of his car to look for stolen vehicles.
It has paid dividends. We've caught some people involved in some serious crimes because of the LPR. And I know it's helped out a lot of other agencies in the area as well.
The use of LPRs is growing across the United States. Some are mounted on poles, others on cars, and privacy groups are concerned. They say the information is being stored on computer servers and shared with local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies. Jay Stanley is with the American Civil Liberties Union.
But what they're also doing is they're storing everybody's time, place, and location. And many police departments are holding that information indefinitely. You know, in our society, the government doesn't follow you and invade your privacy and track you unless it has specific reason to believe that you are involved in wrongdoing.
At night, the infrared will still read the tag.
Arlington Police Captain Kevin Reardon heads the Homeland Security Division. He says LPR information is kept for 6 months, but other law enforcement agencies with access to their server may store it indefinitely.
We originally had a 2-month period, and the detectives requested the chief to extend it to 6 months because they found in some of the investigations keeping it only 2 months wasn't long enough.
Privacy advocates say they have no problem with police departments scanning license plates to investigate crimes, but they are opposed to storing information for long periods of time.
Once you're past, a certain period of time, it's very unlikely that it's going to be useful. Meanwhile, we're creating this giant infrastructure for tracking everybody all the time.
And they keep bringing up the word tracking. And if I went out and ran your tag in our server, I would not be able to track you. I would be lucky if I could put you a few places in Arlington at a particular time, but by no stretch of the imagination would I be able to track you.
But the ACLU says Americans need to know more about LPR technology. It has filed a suit in federal court against the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security to see how federal officials are using the LPR information they acquire. Jeff Swicord, VOA News, Arlington, Virginia.
Hours after the Obama administration declassified secret orders that allowed it to engage in massive surveillance of the phone calls and internet usage of Americans, the head of the National Security Agency openly defended the program. Science World's Bob Doty has more.
General Keith Alexander explained the government's method during a speech in Las Vegas Wednesday before a conference of computer security experts. He told the attendees the NSA was not spying on Americans indiscriminately.
Congress did a review of this program over a 4-year period, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. And over that 4-year period, they found no willful or knowledgeable violations of the law or the intent of the law in this program. More specifically, they found no one at NSA had ever gone outside the boundaries of what we've been given. That's the fact. What you're hearing, what you're seeing, what people are saying is, well, they could. The fact is, they don't.
General Alexander was occasionally heckled during his speech, with at least one attendee accusing him of lying to Congress about the NSA's activities. He urged the crowd to play a constructive role in helping the country find the right balance between national security and protecting civil liberties. The NSA surveillance programs were leaked by former contractor Edward Snowden to the British newspaper The Guardian last month. Earlier this past week, the newspaper disclosed details of another clandestine NSA program leaked by Snowden, X-Keyscore. The newspaper said the agency boasted that X-Keyscore is its widest-reaching system, with analysts able to monitor online internet chats and the browsing history of millions of internet users. For Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
And it's time once again for the Science World Quick Quiz. This week, our subject area is cybersecurity. We'd like to know from the following which of these electronic devices so far has not been hacked. A. Remote control garage door openers. B. Cell phones. C. ATMs. D. Automobiles. E. All of the above. Or F. None of the above. Do you think you have the right answer? Stick around. The correct answer is coming up in just a little bit.
You're listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine. With modern technology, forecasters are able to predict bad weather better than ever. But for tornadoes, the false alarm rate has hovered about 75% for decades. Roseanne Skirbel tells us about efforts to improve those forecasts.
Doppler radar reads the weather based on reflections from items moving through the air. Joshua Werman is the first to put it on wheels and drive it directly into the path of a tornado.
I invented the Doppler on wheels back in the 1990s because I was frustrated that we couldn't see enough detail inside tornadoes and hurricanes. We had blurry images of all these things, and in order to really understand the physics, the math of what's going on inside a tornado, how exactly are they forming, how strong are the winds right at the surface, we need to get up very, very close.
So Werman, who directs the Center for Severe Weather Research in Boulder, Colorado, deploys Doppler on wheels to chase storms. His fleet consists of large panel trucks with rotating antenna dishes mounted on the back. Those high-powered antennas send out radio waves that reflect objects in the air, from raindrops to birds. Werman and his team watch the weather patterns in real time from inside the truck.
So I'm seeing it through the computers and through the radar screens, which are making three-dimensional images of the wind and the debris and the rain and hail flowing around the storm.
Weather forecasts based on data from satellites, fixed radar networks, and computer models help guide the trucks to the precise location of a storm that could spawn a tornado. Doppler on wheels has intercepted over 200 tornadoes so far.
When we get up close to a storm while it's in the process of making a tornado, we can look at the evolution of the winds near the surface, how that relates to the winds aloft, how the precipitation, the rain, and the hail influences whether the air is going up or down, whether it's cold or warm, and how that is causing or not causing a tornado to form.
The analysis combines the Doppler images and 3D maps with data from steel weather pods, large heavy metal disks with measuring instruments. Werman says the pods are placed in the path of a storm to collect data from the ground below the range of the radar.
That's where we live. We live right near the ground. Buildings are built right on the ground. And we need to understand more about how the winds do damage, how the debris field interacts with the winds and does damage.
That data could lead to better building design in storm-prone areas. As they observe the life cycle of tornadoes, scientists are getting a better understanding of which storms develop into tornadoes and which die away. One factor revealed by the radar is a secondary wind surge that Werman says could be the trigger mechanism for the tornado.
The scientific process is that we need to now observe that and repeat that observation in maybe a dozen or more other thunderstorms, and maybe a dozen or so thunderstorms that aren't making tornadoes, to really see if that surge causes tornadoes, and if there's no surge, whether there's no tornado.
Doppler on Wheels is an advanced mobile scientific laboratory. Along with hundreds of twisters, it's also chased a dozen or so hurricanes, expanding what we know about those storms. Positioned on the Louisiana coast for Hurricane Gustav in 2008, the fleet captured high-resolution measurements as the hurricane came ashore. Werman says the images show winds in surprising corkscrew rolls.
And that corkscrewing motion does two things. One, it brings strong winds down to the surface, and those stronger winds have a much greater potential to cause damage. But in addition, on the way back up, those winds are carrying heat and moisture from the ocean, which is basically the food, the fuel for a hurricane.
Looking at those winds could give forecasters a better idea of the intensity of the storm, which could translate into more accurate forecasts. And that, Werman says, can save lives. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
According to a new study, people with peripheral artery disease not only have a higher risk of having a heart attack or stroke, but they often live with irreversible disability. And as Carol Pearson reports, they are likely to live in low or middle-income nations.
Many people who have peripheral artery disease don't know they have it. And yet PAD, as it's known, dramatically increases their risk of stroke and heart attack. Researchers have found that stroke patients with peripheral artery disease are three times as likely to have a second stroke, a heart attack, or die a few years after having the initial stroke. PAD is a circulatory problem. It occurs when fatty deposits in the arteries restrict blood flow to the legs and feet. The disease severely limits the ability to walk. Tissue can die, and gangrene can set in, requiring amputation. Estimates suggest that PAD is increasing in every region of the world. Yet until now, there was no global study on its prevalence. The first one was just published in the Lancet Medical Journal. Dr. Alan Hirsch wrote a comment on the study, conducted by researchers at the University of Edinburgh. He spoke to VOA via Skype.
No single study can answer that question as to why PAD is both so common and increasing in prevalence. But these authors and other research would suggest that it's a combination of a wider exposure to the risk factors that cause artery blockages, like smoking, high blood pressure, diabetes, and cholesterol.
But of all of the risk factors, he says, one stands out.
Without doubt, the most important one is tobacco smoke in all of its forms.
The research shows that peripheral artery disease is expected to continue to rise dramatically. And about 70% of those who have PAD live in low or middle income countries, mainly in Southeast Asia and the Western Pacific regions. Hirsch says the study should be a call to action for public health officials around the world to start education campaigns.
When a disease is this common, the answer is usually prevention, and prevention starts with an awareness of risk.
The key, he says, is to persuade people to give up bad habits. Hirsch says that for a pandemic already affecting a quarter of a billion people, local, national, and international health officials have to start getting the word out now. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
Okay, let's see if you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz. We wanted to know from the following, which of these electronic devices so far has not been hacked? A, garage door openers? B, cell phones. C, ATMs. D, automobiles. E, all of the above. Or F, none of the above. Well, this was really an easy quick quiz this week, since the answer is E, all of the above. Yes, even automobiles are not immune from harmful cyber intrusions. Two former hackers, now security experts, recently demonstrated just how vulnerable most cars built today are to cyber attacks. By tapping into the car's network of computers that controls a wide variety of functions, the duo was able to remotely jerk the wheel of a car driving at high speeds, make it accelerate or brake, and even disrupt onboard systems that were built to keep the car's occupants safe. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
A newly released study from the University of California, Berkeley, and Princeton University has found a strong link between shifts in climate to human violence around the world. The study noted that climate deviations that were as minor as very slight changes in normal temperature and rainfall could greatly increase the risk of conflict. Study co-author Edward Miguel, a professor at UC Berkeley, joins us today for our one-on-one segment to tell us why a deviation in climate could play a role in determining human behavior.
Everything from crime all the way up to society-wide forms of violence like civil war. And what we did that was different than other researchers is we combined data and evidence across a large number of fields. So we didn't just look at our home field of economics. We also looked at data from political science, geography, psychology, archaeology, and we put together 60 quantitative studies, so a large number of studies that all had rich data sets that we could use in the statistical analysis. And when we bring all that evidence together in the statistical analysis, we find very strong evidence of a climate conflict link. Adverse climate leads to more conflict.
What do you define as climate shifts? I mean, we're looking at temperature changes, monsoons. What type of climate are we talking about?
There are different definitions in the different studies. About half the studies focus on temperature. That's really the bulk of the studies, and there's very strong relationships between temperature itself, just degrees Celsius, and violence. But the other studies look at various forms of rainfall variability, from very low rainfall or extreme rainfall to other measures of drought, et cetera. So there's several different measures used, but a lot of the studies focus on temperature. And of course, when we look forward at climate change and global warming, thinking about future temperature increases is really critical. There's a prediction that most of the climate models make that the world will warm by about 2 degrees Celsius on average to 2050. So over the next 30 or 40 years, that's almost 4 degrees Fahrenheit. And our study has very important implications for what that climate change will do. And namely, that climate change, that global warming, will contribute to greater human violence. And what was quite remarkable about the study is when we look at the statistical patterns at all of these different scales, from the very local scale all the way up to the society-wide scale, we find very similar patterns. Adverse climate, like extremely hot temperatures or extremely low rainfall, are associated with more violence at all of these different scales.
Okay, we've been talking primarily about global warming and warming climates. How about when we go through periods of very cold temperatures?
One of the sets of studies we looked at were historical or archaeological studies, and that allows us to look at very long-term changes in temperature over a century or more. And one of the findings there is that if you do look at extended periods of time, very sharp deviations from normal climate, whether they be extremely hot temperatures or extremely cold temperatures, are both associated with political instability and conflict. So one of the studies that we bring into our paper is a study that looks at the Mayan civilization, the Mayan Empire, which during the 800s AD, so during the 9th century AD, experienced an unprecedented century of warm, dry weather. In fact, they had 3 mega droughts during that century. And at the end of the 3rd mega drought, that's the time at which that civilization collapsed into civil war, never to recover its previous grandeur. But there have also been periods in European history with extremely cold temperatures. You know, I think the basic finding is extreme rainfall or extreme temperature on either end that takes people out of the normal range of human climate could both be very dangerous in terms of conflict and instability.
What about recent examples?
There are plenty of them. There's recent studies that, for instance, look at hot, dry temperature in Somalia and violence there. We know that's a very unstable country. It's also a very hot and dry country. And when you do have temperature spikes on top of what's already a very hot place, that's associated with political violence in Somalia. So Somalia is an African case where you can see this come through very clearly in the data. There's another recent study looking at high temperatures and domestic violence in India. So it turns out if a certain location experiences anomalously hot temperatures in India, you see more violence against women. So these findings really occur around the world. There's another interesting study that is not a temperature study, it's a rainfall study from Brazil. So some of your listeners may be familiar with the fact that there are land invasions in Brazil. There's a landless people's movement that organizes raids on land in Brazil. Well, it turns out when rainfall is really bad, either way too much or way too little rainfall in a given year, in those years you see spikes in the number of land invasions in Brazil. So really there are very concrete examples just from our contemporary world, from all around the world, where you see the same pattern. Adverse climatic conditions are associated with more violence.
Could your findings possibly be used to create a model to predict future trends and possible trouble spots, perhaps lead to developing strategies to dealing with these kinds of problems?
There are at least 2 different approaches you could take given these findings. The first is, after documenting these relationships, you could imagine building better forecasts for where there'll be violence going forward. So if we know, for instance, that temperatures are rising very quickly in a part of the world that is prone to civil conflict, that is a trouble spot, and that is a place where governments and foreign aid donors and other agencies should focus their efforts. So there's certainly the potential to use this data to do some forecasting of hotspots. The second implication and the second direction that policy could go here would be to use these results really to understand just how high the stakes are for our dealing with climate change and start thinking about ways where we can look forward at the next 40 or 50 years, look at the changing climate, and try to craft new policies to deal with changing climate. If we can develop technologies and approaches that are more resilient to a changing climate, that may be our only way out.
That was Edward Miguel from the University of California, Berkeley. Thanks so much for listening. We'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog, voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.